Good morning, everyone. The Ways and Means meeting is called to order. Clerk will note the roll. We have a quorum. Members, we have the minutes of the February 15th meeting before us. Representative Carlson moves approval of the minutes. Any corrections, additions, changes to the minutes? Seeing none, all in favor of approving the minutes of February 15th, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The minutes of February 15th are approved. Members, we have two items of business today, House File 400 and a review of the debt capacity forecast. But before I do that, excuse me, Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chair, if you're going to make an announcement, I'll wait until you were about to say something.
Oh, okay. Well, I was just going to recognize there are a number of people from my area here, District 13 and 14, the St. Cloud, Sartell, St. Joseph area. I'm not going to recognize them all, but I just wanted to say welcome and thanks for coming down to visit us at the legislature today. Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, House File 400 you've got on the agenda. And unfortunately, you and I didn't get a chance to visit this morning about it, but it's my understanding that some of the interested parties are involved with some negotiations on what the language of the bill might contain, and this is a request that I've never made before, but I would request that you perhaps lay this bill over to allow those negotiations to continue among the interested parties and perhaps take the bill up at a later date. I'm not going to make that in the form of a motion, but just a request, because as chair you would have the power to simply lay it over if you would choose. And it does deal rather heavily with foreign policy related issues, and I think it would be something that probably would serve both sides of the aisle well if those negotiations were able to take place and move forward while the bill is still here in committee.
Well, Representative Carlson, I guess I know one other member from your side had mentioned something to me like that just now before the meeting, too, and I guess I'm a little reluctant to just do that on the spur of the moment here. I guess I'd probably want to hear from the author what he had to say as well, because we did schedule the bill. I mean, it's been on the agenda with people knowing it was going to come up since last week. We certainly could, if there are other negotiations or things that happen, there could, of course, be an amendment on the floor. I guess what I'd probably say, why don't I get Representative Tricia to come forward and present the bill, and I guess we can ask him about it as well, Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chair, I understand that there could conceivably be an amendment on the floor as a result of the negotiations, but in my experience, it's always easier legislatively if need be, if it's done in a committee in a little smaller working group than 134 members on the House floor. And especially when it's a bill in this particular case that deals with foreign affairs.
Well, thank you, Representative Carlson. I think let's have Representative Tricia come forward and present the bill, and he can maybe inform us of what he knows on that issue as well. Representative Tricia, welcome to the Committee on Ways and Means. The Chair will move that House File 400 be referred to the General Register. Representative Tricia, why don't you present your bill, and then I know that people have some questions for you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'll just get right to it. The bill you have in front of you has gone through a number of negotiations and conversations, and they've been good. And I'll keep talking about this. This bill just simply says that if a company chooses to discriminate against Israel using the BDS movement, that they would not be able to get a state contract. We're not taking anybody's right away. We can't do that, frankly, for them to speak out against Israel or to speak in favor of the BDS movement. If you want to put a banner in your business that says you don't support Israel, you can do that before and after this. But just like we've done with the Women's Economic Security Act, with minority groups, we're simply saying if you discriminate against Israeli companies and Jewish companies that the state doesn't want to subsidize that discrimination. So, if I could address Representative Carlson's questions and concerns.
Please.
So I understand, as with anything that's controversial, that there are conversations. Let me tell you about the path of this, and let me tell you about what I've done and the parties involved. So when we first started out, I had bipartisan support, and I still do. It's moving in the Senate, and we've been talking to the ACLU and other groups that have been interested in this. In that time, we have changed the language to remove occupied territories. We have changed the language from boycott to discrimination. I have signed on to Representative Hornstein's bill, which I think is a good faith effort to address this on a broader concern. I'm happy to work that through the committee process. Let me ask you what shouldn't happen. As we know down here, momentum means everything. And because this bill is moving, people are talking. We're in negotiations now with the ACLU. I think we can come to an agreement on how we can make this amenable to all the parties and come with a very good bill. My goal is to have as many votes as I can on the House floor. If you allow us to continue with that process, and if you allow me to keep moving the bill forward, I will give you my word that I will continue those talks and I'll keep working on it. However, if this bill and the momentum stops, I have found that the conversations stall as well. I think we've made great progress. I think the language that we're working on with the ACLU and the amendment that we can possibly offer on the House floor would be a continued step forward. I would ask that you would allow me to keep doing that process and allow my word to stand as it is, and I will tell you I will do the very best to get a bill that everybody can support.
Okay, members, under House rules, we are, of course, required to take testimony. I don't know of anyone who has contacted me who is a proponent of the bill, other than, of course, the author who wants to testify. Is there anyone here who is a proponent that wanted to testify today?
Mr. Chair, if I could.
Representative Khrushchev.
I do have a couple of folks that I might call down that have been supporters of mine, but part of the reason I've asked them not to is because, as I understand it, today we're dealing with the fiscal note, the 6,000 or some whatever the department has put. So I was hoping we would stay to that and to that germaneness, but obviously I'll leave it up to you as the chair of the committee.
Well, Representative Khrushchev, certainly if you or they want to testify, that's fine, but there's no requirement that they do so. And yes, being this is the fiscal community, we normally want to try to stay focused on the fiscal effects. I do have four people who contacted us who wanted to testify against the bill. I understand you have some who wanted to testify for, and I guess I would like to take the first person who contacted us, a Mr. Barry Cohen, to testify against the bill. And so if he would come forward. Mr. Cohen, welcome to the Committee on Ways and Means. Please state your name for the record, and then give us your statement, and we'll be happy to hear from you.
Thank you much, Mr. Chair. My name is Barry Cohen. I'm a resident of St. Paul, Minnesota. Happy to be here this morning. And I know this is a fiscal committee, but I do want to reiterate what the ACLU has said in terms of this being unconstitutional. And from a fiscal standpoint, it's likely that if this bill did pass in the form that it was, it would be tested in the courts. I want to quote from Abraham Foxman, former director of the Anti-Defamation League, who in our Jewish community, the ADL is one of the foremost, if not the foremost, organization in the United States dedicated to combating anti-Semitism. And Mr. Foxman said, and I quote, "Legislation that bars boycott, divestment, and sanction activity by private groups, whether corporations or universities, strikes at the heart of the First Amendment-protected free speech, and it will be challenged in the courts and is likely to be struck down. A decision by a private body to boycott Israel," and he does not support this. He says, I quote, "as despicable as it may be, is protected by our Constitution." I want this committee and other committees to consider moving forward on this. But constitutional issues aside, are there still any libertarians left in our legislature? In principle, don't you support allowing businesses to decide where, when, and how they do business? If a business, is, as a matter of conscience, chooses not to contract with Israel, a nation that has had a terrible human rights record in the occupied territories, are you prepared to tell them that they can't do business in Minnesota? And why just single out Israel for this kind of protection? Egypt, Ethiopia, Saudi Arabia, like Israel, receive billions of dollars in military aid. Israel receives $5 billion. It's the leading recipient of U.S. military aid in the world, and the other four follow in the top 10. Receiving billions of dollars in U.S. aid, they're our allies, but they all are involved in human rights violations. I also find it ironic that in every hearing I've been in so far, that the majority has unanimously voted in favor of this new regulation at a time that you're telling us that government is going to be taken off our back, and for every new regulation that we add, we should remove too. For 16 years, I was the director of a not-for-profit business and had easily a dozen and a half contracts with the state and applied for at least twice that number. And I can tell you the expense, the opportunity costs to contract with Minnesota are extremely high. Your Department of Administration has shown you a document that's how many pages long? 50 or so pages long. We as contractors have a huge burden in terms of preparing contracts for the state. Each new regulation requires more work on our part. Very expensive, and all this regulatory burden favors those who are the larger contractors at the expense of those who are smaller ones. And in concluding, I want to say something that one of your members who will vote for this bill said about this bill. He called it the blueberry muffin. And my first reaction was, what's the blueberry muffin? Well, that's the state muffin. His point, there's many bills that are passed on behalf of a constituency that we can all feel good about and do this to support them. And it, what's the benefit to the state of Minnesota? Who's going to benefit from this? How does it contribute to the health, the economy, the education, the infrastructure, safety of our state if this bill gets passed? And who will it harm? So in this case, you may be satisfying a particular constituency who, out of their conviction, supports Israel unconditionally and unquestioningly. But for those of us, including many Jews like myself, and for people in other faith groups who you'll hear from who are critical of Israeli policy, we find this bill disturbing and not at all pleased by its intent to squelch, and I'll use the word squelch, boycott, sanction, and divestment. So I would say this bill is another muffin, but it's half-baked, stale, and dangerous threat to our Constitution. I don't want you to buy it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cohen. Representative Davids?
Yes, Mr. Cohen.
Mr. Cohen? One of the members has a question for you, if we could.
I was just wondering, Mr. Cohen, if you had any testimony that had to do with the bill before us at this time regarding fiscal issues.
Well, I raised the fiscal issue. I mean, there's a cost here every time you add a regulation, both to us and I presume to the state in terms of whatever you have to put in place to monitor this kind of activity. At this time, you can ask your own administration department people if there are any organizations that are now involved in a boycott. I don't think there are any.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would just suggest that future testifiers stick to the issue before the Ways and Means Committee, which is the cost to the state. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Well, thank you, Representative David. He did mention that, I know, in his testimony. Thank you, Mr. Cohen. Representative Kresha?
And to Representative Davids, one interesting thing I thought I would bring up in the Women's Economic Security Act, where we did essentially the same thing, except we would ask that CEOs certify whether or not they discriminate against women-owned businesses. The department, as we've been able to tell, the department administration had offered no fiscal note at that time. So the question that I have to your point on the fiscal note is, why is the department bringing up a fiscal note now? And that's fine if it's appropriate, but more importantly, why have we chosen that it's okay to support women-owned businesses but not to support the Israeli companies? And why, I'm curious why the Department of Administration has taken that stance.
Well, members, I would direct your attention to the fiscal note that is in your packets that says that the estimate is that there would be a cost to the state of $7,000 over the next 2 years if we pass this bill. Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, just on the how narrow the testimony has to be, as we all know, sometimes policy and fiscal questions go hand in hand, and that's the way I interpreted the testimony from Mr. Cohen. As you point out, as chair, he did reference the cost, but the committee has never been overly restrictive in terms of questions coming up about policy that might be in a bill that is here because of its fiscal cost. And of course, this one meets the threshold to bring it to Ways and Means. But I just want to point out to the committee as a reminder that they sometimes go hand in hand, and I don't think we want to be overly restrictive in terms of the testimony.
And Representative Carlson, I would agree with you. We have certainly custom and usage been not very restrictive in the testimony that we take, other than limiting the amount of testimony to maybe one proponent and one opponent, just in the interest of time and the fact that normally by the time a bill gets to Ways and Means, there's been a lot of testimony, frequently by the people that want to testify in Ways and Means in other previous committees. But you're right, Representative Carlson, I agree with you, and I expect that we will continue to have a policy of willingness to hear most testimony.
Thank you.
All right. I guess I've got Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question for Mr. Cohen, if you could come back, please.
Yes.
Okay. Okay. If you feel you need to, Representative Fabian.
Thank you.
Welcome back, Mr. Cohen. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Cohen, you talked about the cost of regulations and so forth in your testimony on this bill. Are there other regulations in state government that impact your companies and the contracts that they do that you've testified against?
It's been a while. No,
Mr. Cohen.
Yes, I'm a retired exec. It's been a while. But I can tell you that each contract is different with each department and division. And an organization of our size that had a budget of about $1 million a year, one contract with the Department of Transportation, you would think we were paving 100 miles of highway. It was like one size fits all. It's the same contracting procedure. It was huge, and then the negotiations went on for like 3 months.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Cohen, my question was, is have you testified before a committee before with regards to regulations that you feel are overly burdensome?
Have I?
Said that, Cohen.
No, I never have.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Thank you again, Mr. Cohen.
Sure, I appreciate it.
Okay. Representative Wagenius and Liebling. Representative Wagenius.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. With regard to the cost issue, Mr. Cohen did bring up the high likelihood that if this bill passed, there would be a constitutional challenge. And we, of course, would be paying the legal fees on behalf of the state. And I think we cannot ignore those dollars as we discuss issues. Most of the time, you can't say that there will be a high likelihood of a constitutional challenge. There certainly wouldn't have been a high likelihood of a constitutional challenge with regard to the women's security But in this case, there is. And so I think cost is definitely an issue that is squarely before us.
Representative Lublin.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I wanted to say a couple of things. One, Representative Rodriguez just covered about the constitutional challenge and the potential cost of that, which is not mentioned in the fiscal note. The other thing is that the Women's Economic Security Act is an act that is about benefiting women in the state of Minnesota. It's not an act about having the state of Minnesota conduct some kind of interfere or get involved in foreign policy. It's about women in the state of Minnesota, and I think the comparison is, really unfortunate here, because I think that even if it costs the state a little bit to make sure that women in the state of Minnesota get a fair shake and that women's businesses get a fair shake when it comes to dealing with state government, I think that's worth a little bit of money. I'm not so sure that we want to burden our businesses in Minnesota to make sure that they do foreign policy the way the state of Minnesota might want them to. The other thing, Mr. Chair, that I just wanted to bring up, I appreciate that your comment about letting people speak here about policy, because on the floor last week I did ask you and Representative Pepin about policy and fiscal bills, and both of you said very clearly that you are not opposed to having policy in your fiscal bills. And I think that being the case, that gives another reason why we should be allowed to discuss the policy here in this committee, whether or not it's connected with any fiscal issue. So I appreciate that, Mr. Chair. And at least, as you might guess, I disagree with your position on that. I do not think that policy should be in fiscal bills unless it really needs to be there to implement the fiscal issues. However, I at least appreciate that you are being consistent, and thank you.
Thank you, Representative Lublin. And yes, I think everyone knows, at least underneath my chairmanship the last couple of years, we've had a tradition of letting people testify on policy issues and having policy issues in the bill. Many times they do eventually affect the fiscal health of the state as well. I'm going to, Representative Krisha, did you want to respond to some of the comments that were made?
If I could, please. Mr. Chair, so first of all, on the Women's Economic Security Act, I'm not holding it up as I'm opposed to it. I actually was on the conference committee. I support it. I'm holding it up as a precedent that if we are going to say that the state should not subsidize businesses that discriminate against women, that same standard could apply here. The other thing that I would say on the constitutionality of, the concerns of the constitutionality of this have been so great that President Obama has supported it. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton has come out against the BDS efforts and has said that states should take a position on this because of the movement, the BDS movement and the detrimental effects that it's having. Also, 16 other states have passed this with no constitutional challenges. And now the Governor Dayton has indicated he would sign it. And as you know, Keith Ellison, or maybe you don't know, has come out against BDS as well. So I understand those concerns and I hear those, but apparently they haven't come to fruition.
Members, I should say for people who are new on the committee, since this really hasn't come up yet in the first couple months of our session this year, when we talk about the potential for lawsuits on a bill, I certainly think that that is a issue to consider. I mean, it is a potential liability of the state, but if people wonder why it's not in the fiscal note, it's because we have traditionally said that the assumption is that if a bill is coming forward that it is constitutional, that the Attorney General has a significant budget with many attorneys on their staff to defend the state in the event there are constitutional challenges, and that because of that we assume that any cost to the state are in the Attorney General's budget to defend us if, in fact, a lawsuit was brought. And so I bring that up not as a particular comment on this bill, but just for members that are new on the committee that haven't heard about this aspect of the fiscal notes, for them to know that the reason there's no potential fiscal cost in the bill for a lawsuit. We have had other bills, you know, most of the bills that come before us, probably there's no chance that there would be a lawsuit, but there are occasional ones where certainly the likelihood is higher, and the reason we don't make any estimate of that or carry that in the fiscal note is because it's assumed to be in the Attorney General's budget. And so I just bring that up as a point of information for people. let's see, I don't see any, oh, Representative Hausman, did you have a question?
Well, to the author, to just help me with one thing, I haven't been on any of the other committees that have discussed this, but what your bill says is if you discriminate against this country, can you help me with why you would draft a bill that would name one country that we might discriminate against but none other? What, how does that work?
Representative Khrushchev.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Hausman, frankly, because there's been no other BDS movements of this kind against other countries. This has been very narrowly targeted. This is a discrimination that has moved through Europe, and it's been very narrowly targeted towards Israel, so I'm addressing the Israel issue. If that other conversation, I've already signed on to Representative Weinstein's bill, which is more broad, let's have that conversation. But I'm saying here, if we don't support discrimination against Israel, and we believe that discrimination against any country is also bad, then the whole, then the specific and the whole are the same, so let's start with the specific and move to the whole.
I see no other questions for Representative Khrushchev, so I'm wondering, Representative Hornstein, if it would be appropriate for you to offer your amendment.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, and thank you, Representative Khrushchev, for mentioning this amendment. I would like to speak to the DE3 as an alternative approach to addressing this issue.
Representative Hornstein moves the DE3 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And of course, I when this bill came forward and I heard about it, I have a strong connection to the subject matter. Most of my extended family actually lives in Israel. I've shared this with some members, but maybe not all of you, that both of my parents are Holocaust survivors. They lost much in what we call the Shoah. My mother's family was Polish. She lost both of her parents and both of her brothers. My father, who was Hungarian, lost his parents and a brother and sister. But two of his brothers survived and moved to Israel. So I've gone there many, many times and you know, been very strongly connected all of my life. So I care deeply about this issue. I also oppose boycotts. However, I think there's a better way of approaching this. And when I looked at the bill for the first time when it was introduced, I did identify three areas of concern. And thank you, Representative Khrushchev, for addressing the first one that had to do with the state codifying, in essence, some issues that are in discussion in foreign policy, which are Israel's final borders. I didn't think it was appropriate at all for us to take a stand on that. We'd be the House Foreign Affairs Committee, Mr. Chairman, not the House Ways and Means Committee, had that remained in the bill. My second concern does relate to what members have brought up several times today, which is the constitutionality of this bill. And while I think that there's legal opinions on both sides, the fact of the matter is, even beyond the ACLU, I've had a chance to talk to some attorneys, and they raise similar concerns about free speech. And so if that can be addressed, and I understand there's some conversations about that, that would be useful for us. And thirdly, I think there are some issues with its implementation, and I've had some conversations with the Department of Administration, and I hope those issues can be worked through. But the DE3 amendment, does address my concerns and may concerns that I've heard, quite frankly, on both sides of the aisle, and that is that we have a bill that is constitutional. I don't think there's any question that the DE3 would pass constitutional muster. I have an opinion from House Research to that effect. And the second thing that the DE3 does is it looks at discrimination that's already in state law. This does not really add anything that's not already in state law except for national origin in contracts. So if there's discrimination against anyone from any nationality, that would be prohibited in state contracts. And so, therefore, I think many Minnesotans would benefit from the DE3. And I think it would also address the concerns of the people that had brought this bill forward. In fact, it's an approach that's in a pending bill in Massachusetts that's supported by Jewish community organizations left, right, and center. So I you know, again, would like to move this for discussion, Mr. Chair, and be happy to answer any questions.
Representative Hornstein has moved the DE3 amendment. Representative Kreshaw.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Hornstein. I do think this is another path that we should be considering. I very much appreciate it. When you offered it to me on the House floor, I signed on that day. I would add, if this bill covers my bill, then if A equals B and B equals C, then A equals C. So I would agree that this would be a good starting point, and that if my bill is covered by this one, then let's take this one and take it back to the committee process to make sure that we also deal with the administration, the fiscal notes, because this would expand that. And what I would offer, and the other thing that I want to say is I would offer that, and I don't know what your intentions are, but if you would withdraw this, that we would continue the conversations with that. Also knowing that I am having conversations with ACLU now to try to mitigate all the concerns that I'm hearing from them. I mean, this is not, today what you see is not the final resting place of this language, which I'm trying very hard to get to a compromise with everybody. So my commitment would be that if we could continue that path, I would continue to support the efforts that you're doing, and maybe we can get to it with multiple paths. Something to offer.
Representative Hornstein.
Well, Mr. Chair, I appreciate that, and I appreciate our conversation about the DE3 that we had a couple of days ago. And as I indicated to you, I wanted to put this out here for discussion purposes and not necessary for a vote today. But Representative Kreshia, if, in fact, this bill can be heard, and I imagine it would go through the same committee process as yours did, GovOps, State Government Finance, potentially here, I would very much welcome that and continue the conversation with you because I do believe that the DE3 presents us with a neater, cleaner, constitutional path towards, I think, the goal that a lot of us share bipartisanly. So, I mean, I'm happy to, again, answer any other committee members' questions, but that is my position, that we should be looking at the DE3.
Other members have questions. Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Hornstein. My understanding of this issue is somewhat limited and new, and I've seen the divestment proposal that was brought forward at the University of Minnesota, and that was very troubling to me. Our state's university, my university, was pushing something like that, and they weren't pushing it against any of the other countries in the world. They were pushing it against Israel. And whether or not you think that's anti-Semitic or not, I think it's unfair, and that it was specifically targeted towards Israel for whatever reason. And I think that Representative Kreshia is trying to get at that. And I think we're probably not going to make everybody happy on this issue by the end, because I don't think everybody's going to be happy on this issue. But I think we should do what's fair and what's right, particularly with the University of Minnesota. I just find that very troubling. So would you, Representative Hornstein, do you support Representative Kreshia's bill and what it's doing, or do you think that's not a path that we could move forward? Or do you think this is the only path, and would this do everything that Representative Kreshia's bill does? Because as I look at it, it looks kind of too smooth to do what it needs to do.
Well, Representative Hornstein, usually we don't ask people about whether they're supporting or opposing a particular bill, but Representative Hornstein, do you want to respond to that?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Dean. I indicated in my opening comments that I don't support the movement to boycott Israel, but I do have concerns about the constitutionality of House File 400. And so one of the reasons I introduced the DE3 was to address that particular issue. But Representative Kreshia did, I think, as I've thought about his bill and I've thought about some of the changes that have been made since it was introduced, this idea of discrimination in state contracts is an important one. And I don't think we've really taken a good long look at this for a while. And the fact of the matter is that we, by adding national origin, you know, we can really get at a lot of issues, and a lot of Minnesotans could benefit from that. And that's the approach taken in another state, and I looked at their language and saw that it could really be applied to Minnesota. So I think we can get at the issues that Representative Crecia is trying to address, as well as some broader issues around discrimination in state contracts. And so that's why the DE3, I believe, is a proper approach, because we get at the constitutional question and we get at discrimination at the same time.
And Representative Dean, when I said, you know, there's some House rule that talks about not asking how someone's going to vote, and so I guess I want to be a little careful about that. But I also think it's, we have two similar, we have a bill and an amendment that's somewhat similar here, so I know what you're trying to get at too, Representative Dean. So that's the reason I said it that way. But anyway, Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And no, I'm not trying to badger Representative Hornstein into a corner or anything. I'm just trying to figure out what about this doesn't work. And I'm sure if this goes to the floor, when it goes to the floor, we'll probably see this amendment or one similar to it will likely be brought up at that time, and I want to kind of understand the issue as best I can before we have to vote it on the floor. But I really do think with the movement at the U and around the country that we really need to pay close attention to this. So thank you.
Other discussion to the DE3 amendment? Representative Liebling.
So, Mr. Chair and members, I also have ties to Israel. I have been there a couple of times. My daughter spent time there on a program for many months. You know, so, and of course, I'm Jewish as well. I am opposed to this bill. I'm also opposed to the BDS movement, have been absolutely no question. And constituents of mine who've come to me and asked me to support the BDS movement know that I have refused to do that. That said, what bothers me about this bill, which purports to be all about yay, rah, rah, we're protecting Israel, and I must say here parenthetically that when Representative Crecia introduced this, he said, and against Jewish people. And frankly, I don't see anything in the bill that talks about Jewish people unless everyone assumes that everyone in Israel is Jewish, which clearly is not the case. So, you know, this bothers me, I guess, kind of in the same way that the BDS movement itself bothers me, that why in the Minnesota legislature are we singling out Israel to discuss its foreign policy, to, you know, obviously there are some real struggles going on within Israel with the Palestinians that have been perplexing presidents, U.S. presidents, for a very long time. Very difficult questions of foreign policy. And yet here we are wading into this in the Minnesota legislature. I think that First Amendment part of this really troubles me a lot. I think it's a really big slippery slope. Although I'm really opposed to the BDS movement, as a legislator, as somebody who has the part of the control of the levers of state power, I think that for us to start punishing people for exercising their views in whatever way they think is appropriate is really inappropriate, although I find those views and that activity really, you know, I'm opposed to that activity personally. And yet I support their right to express their own views. I think that having this bill moving through the Minnesota legislature is absolutely not helpful to Israel. That's just my own personal view. I think that foreign affairs need to be conducted by the appropriate people in Washington, D.C., and that we here in the Minnesota legislature should not be weighing into this because, you know, this just invites a complete rehashing of whether, you know, is Israel right, is Israel wrong, is their government being, you know, are their policies being conducted properly, what are their borders, all of this that I just think is ultimately does not help. And so I think that Representative Hornstein's amendment is very appropriate. Certainly I, of all people, do not want to see Jews discriminated against, nor do I want to see anyone else discriminated against in our contracting. But to single out one nation where we could be having a whole list of every nation we could have in this bill. And so if we were going to do that, there's really no point at all. So that's why I am opposed to this bill. I think it's very unfortunate that this is moving through. I think that it's we have a lot of things that we can be doing in the Minnesota legislature. I don't think foreign policy should be one of them. Thank you.
Representative Kreshaw.
And thank you for those comments, and thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Representative Lubling. You know, I didn't just draw Israel out of a hat. I didn't just draw this name out. There's a reason. With over 200 motions against Israel in the UN, and with President Obama not supporting this, and as I said, Secretary Hillary Clinton has suggested that states take this action. Her words on this, as you know, BDS seeks to punish Israel and dictate how the Israelis and Palestinians should resolve the core issues in their conflict. I'm not saying we litigate that matter or get in the middle, but I'm just saying that this BDS movement has targeted that. And this is a response to that targeting. If that's all I'm saying, I mean, what I've heard in three committees now is not, what I've heard is I don't support BDS, but yeah, I really do, and I want it to go on. And so, for me, I'm just saying I'm taking a stance on this. I'm offering you a bill, and that's what we do in the legislature. If you don't agree with my stance that we should not subsidize the BDS efforts, then I guess there's a different alternative than what I'm offering, which is to vote no against this.
Representative Hornstein?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I don't know if there's any other comments, because I would like to withdraw the amendment formally from consideration unless there's additional discussion. Just make a closing comment, if that's okay, Mr. Chair.
I don't have anyone else. Oh, Representative Carlson, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, being that the amendment is withdrawn and...
Well, it's not withdrawn yet.
Oh.
I thought it was... He says he's going to withdraw it, but he'd like to make a comment.
Oh, okay. I'll wait for Representative Hornstein's comment then. Thank you.
So, okay, Representative Hornstein.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you for the discussion, and thank you, Representative Kreshaw, for your openness to this. I would just say in conclusion that now this is not, I will say that, you know, I'm opposed, of course, to a boycott of Israel, and can cite many reasons, but we don't have the time. It's not appropriate at this point. But I would just say that if we're going to do a bill like this, it needs to pass constitutional muster. And it doesn't do anyone any good if this bill does not, and it's challenged in court. And so that's ultimately what I hope can happen. I believe my bill does it well. I believe that national origin is an important criteria so that many Minnesotans be they Somali or Palestinian or Canadian or Norwegian, can benefit from this legislation. As we move forward, I hope, again, this will be considered through the committee process, and I'm encouraged and hopeful that the parties that are addressing the legal issues of this can come to some agreements and some understandings. I'm not an attorney, Mr. Chair, and so I leave it to them, but at this point, I'm uncomfortable just the fact that there's even a constitutional question. And again, I know there's arguments on both sides, as there always are. But the fact that those questions have arisen and continue to arise are uncomfortable to me and need to be resolved. So that's my concern, Representative Kreshaw. And I think we can agree that that a boycott is, for many reasons, is not appropriate. But a bill addressing it does need to pass constitutional muster. And so with that, Mr. Chair, I would withdraw my amendment and will commit to work with Representative Kreshaw to ensure that we get some additional authors on both sides of the aisle and get this bill through the committee process.
Representative Hornstein withdraws the DE3 amendment. Representative Carlson.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I was just going to comment. Representative Kreshaw indicated that he's willing to continue to work on this legislation. So the question that I raised earlier was that that work could take place while it still sits in committee. And I always have felt that the committee process is the strongest way to proceed rather than necessarily amendments on the House floor. And I interpreted the way the things went at the beginning of the meeting that you wanted to have an opportunity for the author to present the bill and have some discussion on it. I'm not going to make a motion that the bill be laid over. I'm just simply making a request of the chair that you give that consideration while these negotiations are going on.
Representative Davids.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I would hope that Representative Crenshaw would like to get this bill out of Ways and Means today. The oldest trick in legislature is have it sit in Ways and Means, and you'll never hear about it again. So I'm hoping that this bill gets to the floor, and that will encourage negotiations.
Representative Davids, I thought they said that about the tax committee.
Nothing about a tax committee.
Says the chair on taxes. Representative Crenshaw.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to the comments from my colleagues. First of all, let me say this. I know this is a tough issue. I know this is deeply personal. It's deeply personal for me. Representative Hornstein, we had a great phone call, and you said something, and I won't get the quote right, but those who think they've been in Israel for a week think they can write a book, and those are, yeah. You know, we spent some time in Israel. I spent a lot of time, we lived there, my whole family, and so I have a personal connection to this as well. And I know, I've heard from the people that have families over there on both sides, Palestinian families as well as Israeli families. So I understand this, and I will tell you to Representative Davids' point, because this bill has been moving, that has kept the negotiations moving as well. I go back to the very first day that I had this bill, and Representative Hornstein and I started on the House floor, and he said, we got to take this out, we got to take this out. We got there, and we keep moving. So my point is, I understand the emotional strife this is causing. I understand the deeply personal side. I also understand that sometimes it's okay to take a stand. And what I will say is I will keep doing my very best to keep those negotiations, allow me the momentum that has got us this far to keep pushing this, and I think we can get to that finish line.
Well, Representative Carlson, I guess what I would say is we scheduled the hearing for today. I guess I didn't realize until this morning that there were people that were maybe interested in having the bill laid over. I do think that, you know, sometimes it's better to have the work done in committee. Sometimes the fact that the bill is moving prompts people to negotiate and come to an agreement. So I think you're right in one sense that it can be true that it's better to do the work in committee, but then sometimes moving the bill also brings people to the table and creates a situation where an agreement can be reached. I thank Representative Hornstein for offering his amendment, because I do think there's a lot of good things in his amendment too. But members, I think that the bill is on the schedule. People have come here to testify today. I think I would like us to have a vote on the bill. Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, just one quick comment. I didn't realize, quite honestly, until this morning that there were negotiations going on relative to the bill. And that's why I didn't have a chance to talk with you, but for me personally, I don't know about other members of the committee, but that was relatively new information. Going in, I knew it would be controversial, but I didn't know that there were negotiations by a variety of groups taking place, and that's why I raised the question if we could allow those negotiations while it was still in committee to take place. But thank you for taking the time.
Sure. Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just, you know, since we're talking about process here, it does feel that this bill is on a fairly fast track. And so I hope that this bill does not come to a vote on the floor before all sorts of options that we've discussed today have been vetted and discussed. And the reason to keep it in committee is that we won't really have a chance to, if there is an agreement, and it's still an if, we don't know. I know I found out over the weekend only that the sides were in discussions, stakeholders were in discussions. And so the advantage of keeping it in committee is that we can take a look at whatever they come up with and then have a chance to have the public vet it in a way that they can't on the House floor. And so I would, you know, reiterate my concerns about that and echo what Representative Carlson said. But perhaps with my bill we'll have that opportunity. But I would just only request that this bill not go to the floor, you know, as quickly as it's gone through the committee process, because there's still many unanswered questions and things that need to be resolved.
Okay. Representative Kreshaw, any last comments?
Thank you for your time and the good discussion.
Okay, members, at this time I'll renew my motion that House File 400 be referred to the General Register. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
Yeah.
No. The motion prevails. House File 400 is referred to the General Register.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members.
Thank you, Representative Kreshaw.
Hey.
Members, the next item on our agenda is a report on debt from the Assistant Commissioner for Debt Management, Jennifer Hassemer. Assistant Commissioner, could you come forward? And Assistant Commissioner, let me say at the outset, thank you for being here on President's Day when just about everyone else is off. We appreciate you being here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jennifer Hassemer. I'm the Assistant Commissioner for Debt Management at Minnesota Management and Budget, and it was my pleasure to come here before you today. There should be two handouts in your packet that I will be using to guide my remarks today. The first is the debt capacity forecast that MMD released in November of 2016, and the second is a one-page bond fact sheet. Starting with the debt capacity forecast, this is a report that MMD issues under statute, state statute, twice a year, and is released in conjunction with the budget and economic forecast in November and February. It includes a statement of indebtedness along with the debt that has been authorized but unissued, an actual and forecasted debt service cost for all net tax-supported debt. On page 4 of the report, it begins a discussion of the state's capital investment guidelines. The reason for having guidelines is to communicate, guide decision-making, and communicate policy goals, and demonstrate a commitment to long-term capital and project financing. The guidelines that MMD implemented in 2009 are consistent with other states and how the rating agencies were viewing the state's debt portfolio. They are inclusive of all of the state's debt obligations, and they represent Minnesota's strong financial management. Pages 4 and 5 of the debt capacity forecast report on what the three guidelines are. I'll go into those in detail in just a moment, but the first two help determine the capacity for additional debt, and the third measures how quickly the state pays down its debt. And I would like to note that the state is in compliance with all three of these guidelines. Guideline number 1 states that total tax-supported principal outstanding or sold shall be 3.25% or less of total state personal income. At the time of this report, guideline number 1 was reporting 2.76% measured against state personal income. The debt that is included in guideline number 1 includes state-issued debt, which includes general obligation, various purpose bonds, and general obligation trunk highway bonds, as well as general fund-supported appropriation bonds. It also includes state-supported debt. So, for example, debt of the University of Minnesota and a housing finance agency that is supported by state standing appropriation, as well as lease purchase financings for real estate. Guideline number 2 looks at measures the total amount of tax-supported principal, both sold and authorized but unsold, for state general obligations, state appropriation bonds, state moral obligations, equipment capital leases, and real estate capital leases. And this amount shall not exceed 6% of total state personal income. At the time of the November debt capacity forecast, the percentage was 3.55%. The debt that is included in the measure for guideline number 2 is all of the debt included in guideline number 1, plus moral obligations of the Housing Finance Agency and the Office of Higher Education, as well as lease purchase financings for equipment. Guideline number 3 states that at least 40% of the state's general obligation bonds are supposed to mature within 5 years and 70% within 10 years. At the time of this report, 40.3% were scheduled to mature within 5 years and 71.2% were scheduled to mature within 10 years. And I would like to note that the Constitution requires that general obligation bonds mature not more than 20 years from the date of issuance. The goal of guideline number 3 is to ensure that the cost of the bonding bills are realized more quickly. I'd like to skip to the table on page 7 in the debt capacity forecast and orient you to this. It is a snapshot of what I've just covered. So what you can see here is a table listing all of the various types of debt that are captured in the capital investment guidelines. On the far left-hand column are the various types of debt specified on a line item basis. The first column of figures represents what is captured by guideline number 1, which is the total debt that has been sold and is outstanding. You can see that at the time of this report, just over $8 billion was outstanding. The middle column of figures shows what has been authorized but not yet sold. And the column on the far right, if you sum that up all the way to the bottom where it's just about $10.4 billion, represents what is captured in guideline number 2, the total amount of authorized debt. At the very bottom of the table, it lists what the forecasted personal income was for the state at the time of the forecast, and then again the percentages that are measured in guidelines number 1 and number 2. Once bonds are first authorized, they will appear in guideline number 2, which is the far right-hand column. And then once bonds are sold, they will appear in guideline number 1, moving to that first column of figures. MMB does not sell the full authorization at one time. Rather, we sell bonds based on a cash flow basis, which means the cost is realized typically over 3 to 5 years. These capital investment guidelines reflect a point in time, and they will be updated in our upcoming February debt capacity forecast. Debt capacity reflects projections. It helps to answer the question of how big the bonding bill could be. The forecast assumes future bonding authorizations based on a historical 10-year rolling average. In the November 2016 forecast, we assumed an $800 million bonding bill would be passed in the 2017 legislature, and $800 million in even years continuing thereafter, and $230 million in odd years thereafter. If you want to turn back to page 6 in the debt capacity forecast, this reports on the estimated maximum debt capacity under the state's current guidelines. I'll point out a couple important things to keep in mind about this page, but first, to draw your attention, as you can see in the table, in fiscal 17, the legislature could authorize $3.45 billion in new debt and still be within our guidelines. But a few important things to note about this table is that the amounts listed in the maximum new debt authorizations line could be allocated among any of the following types of debt: general obligation various purpose bonds, general obligation trunk highway bonds, general fund supported appropriation debt, certificates of participation, and real estate and equipment capital leases. MMD's goal in producing this table was to reach the limit in guideline number 1 or number 2 at the first possible opportunity. And as you can see in this table, the state would hit the limit for guideline number 1 in fiscal 2020. The assumptions in this table are based on forecasted personal income figures, and as those change in future forecasts, this table will likewise change. The bottom line on the table shows additional general fund debt service costs, assuming the maximum debt authorizations was all allocated to general obligation bonds. And now for just a minute, I will turn to the other handout you should have in your packets, the one-page bond fact sheet, to just walk through some of the highlights of the different types of debt that the state issues and sells.
You know, Ms. Hesmer, before you do that, I guess I'd like to, since we're kind of on the point, ask you a question about something you said here.
Sure.
So I'm a little confused. I look at debt capacity guideline number 1, and you've got a box that says estimate of maximum amount of tax-supported debt that could be sold today before exceeding guideline 1, $1.425 billion. But then I go to page 6, which you just said, I think, maximum new debt authorizations within debt guidelines, $3.45 billion. So I guess what's the difference between those two?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Turning first to the figure that you cited on page 5 of the report, the $1.425 billion, that reflects the amount of bonds that we could sell today and still be within guideline number 1. The authorization on page 6 represents the amount that could be authorized today, keeping in mind that we sell bonds on a cash flow basis, so we would not sell the full $3.45 billion today, but rather over a period of 3 to 5 years.
Okay, so you're saying that the assumption would be that if we could authorize $3.45 billion, and the assumption would be that they'd actually be sold over the course of 5 years or something like that, and that's why we would stay below the 3.25% number.
Mr. Chair, that is correct.
All right. Okay. Just wanted to be clear on that. Okay. Thank you. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. So turning to the bond fact sheet, I'll just walk through the categories of bonds on this sheet for you. General obligation bonds are authorized by the Constitution and may only be issued for the purposes specified in the Constitution. They are secured by the full faith and credit of the state, which means that the state will levy a statewide property tax if necessary to meet debt service obligations. The bond authorizations must specify the purposes for which the bonds will be issued and the maximum amount of proceeds for such purposes. The Constitution requires a supermajority vote, and bills must originate in the House. And as I had mentioned previously, the maximum term of general obligation bonds is limited to 20 years. Revenue bonds are another type of financing mechanism where debt service is paid by a pledged revenue stream and not the state's full faith and credit. This pledged revenue stream must have collections in excess of the debt service costs, a concept referred to as the coverage ratio. And this coverage ratio is determined by the market for each particular issue of revenue bonds. Revenue bonds must be authorized by legislative act, which act shall specify the project or program being financed, the dollar amount for the program, and the length of the bonds. And they may be authorized by simple majority vote. And then turning to appropriation bonds, this is yet another financing mechanism where debt service payments are made from amounts appropriated annually by the legislature. This category encompasses several different types of debt. That includes state-issued appropriation bonds, agency-issued appropriation bonds with state-supported debt service, certificates of participation, and lease purchase financings for real estate. There is no legal obligation to continue appropriating funds to make debt service payments. However, rating agencies and investors consider appropriation bonds to be obligations of the state, and any failure to appropriate amounts for debt service would be a reflection on the state's willingness to make good on its commitments and would have negative consequences for future bond issuances, including general obligation bonds. Appropriation bonds must be authorized by specific legislative act, which also must specify the project or program being financed, the dollar amount, and the length of bond, the length of bonds. They can also be authorized by simple majority vote. The maximum maturity when we sell those appropriation bonds will be dependent on the project's life and or market conditions. The purposes for which appropriation bonds may be issued are not limited like general obligation bonds. However, practically, projects must still be for a public purpose, and tax-exempt appropriation bonds must still finance capital projects. However, there is no public ownership requirement as there is with GO bonds. And it's important to note that both general obligation bonds and appropriation bonds count against the state's capital investment guidelines, while revenue bonds do not. So then as I look to conclude my remarks for you today, I just want to refer back to the table on page 7 in the debt capacity forecast again, and I'll walk you through some statistics on the state's outstanding debt portfolio.
Okay, excuse me. I've got a question before we go on to that next subject. Representative Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is likely, again, a newbie question for a new guy on the committee. As I see that you report to the legislature twice a year, in November and February,
and I know there's been a lot of conversation federally that the interest rates are going to start to move.
Mm-hmm.
Does this affect what we do here when interest rates start to shift a bit, and does it change your numbers a lot? I'm just kind of curious. I haven't heard you say much about current interest rates and how we rate this, but I'm just curious how that kind of ties together here. Thank you.
Ms. Hussman.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we have been seeing interest rates increasing in the market, as you mentioned. It will be when the February debt capacity forecast comes out, we'll be able to see what type of movement that is having on the state's forecasted debt service costs. It would potentially have an impact on what we forecast in the future years for debt service costs, but at this point in time, because we don't know the magnitude of any change in the forecasted interest rates, we can't speak to what the magnitude change would be to the general fund.
And to that question, Ms. Hassemer, do you, in putting these forecasts together, do you use an interest rate based on what the state economist is putting in her budget forecast? Or do you assume that all this debt is issued at the interest rate that we've got today? How do you put this together?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We do use forecasted interest rates that come from the IHS Global Insight, the macroeconomist consulting firm that is also used for the budget and economic forecast.
Okay, thank you. I'm sorry I called. I have Representative Hausman on my mind when I said your name earlier, Passimer. So Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the very first point under GO bonds, when you say the state will levy a property tax if necessary, but that is what it means to be backed by the full faith and credit. I'm guessing we have never done that, if ever. What can you tell me? When has that ever been necessary?
Ms. Hassemer.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I believe that has never happened before, that the state has needed to levy a statewide property tax.
Mr. Chair, the reason I asked that, I did see a little bit of response on the part of some committee members when you said that, and I thought maybe people thought we actually do that. So we better be sure to be clear about that. Thank you.
Yes, members, in case you don't know, that is something that is in our Constitution that I think is rather interesting, is that if for some reason we can't balance our budget, the Constitution gives us 3, 4, 5 months after the end of the biennium to figure it all out, but then the independently elected state auditor is required to send out a property tax bill to every parcel of land in the state to balance the budget, which is a excellent way of making sure our budget always gets balanced, because I don't think any of us would want to run and have to explain that in the next election. I have Representative Torkelson, Erdahl, and Vogel. Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the testifier, could you talk a little bit more about certificates of participation, the nature of that sort of indebtedness, and how it has been used in the past?
Ms. Hassemer.
Mr. Chair, Representative, certificates of participation fall under the general category of appropriation debt, where the annual obligations to pay principal and interest needs to come from amounts annually appropriated for that purpose. The distinction between certificates of participation and the more standard state appropriation bonds is that for certificates of participation, there's typically a lease purchase agreement that is involved between different entities, and it is the payments, the rental payments under that lease that are structured to make the annual debt service obligations the principal and interest. On the other hand, state appropriation bonds, the annual amount appropriated by the legislature is intended to cover those costs directly.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. And how have they been used in the past?
Mr. Chair, Representative, what I was going to do in just a minute was walk through the history of the various categories of appropriation bonds that are reflected on page 7 of this worksheet. Skipping ahead briefly, there have been, it looks like, 2 instances where certificates of participation bonds have been issued by the state. And if it's appropriate, well, there are other questions, so I'll hold off on walking through this list at that point in time, but I will come back to that.
Let's see. We'll take longer to walk through that since we're on Representative Torkelson's question.
Mr. Chair, it would just take about 1 or 2 minutes.
Okay, why don't you go ahead and do that?
Okay. So all I was going to point out on this table on page 7 in the debt capacity forecast is that the first top 2 lines represent the outstanding general obligation bonds of the state, which currently total about $6.45 billion. And all of the line itemed bonds and debt below that are all fall into the category of appropriation bonds. And I'll just walk through the list there to give you a sense of when those were authorized and issued and what the original principal amounts were for each of those bonds. The list on this table is unfortunately not in chronological order, but not to confuse the matter, I will just use the order that shows up on the list here so you can track along. First on the list, there were the certificates of participation for the SWIFT accounting system and the integrated tax system that were authorized in 2009 and sold in the original amount of $75 million. There were the City of Bemidji lease revenue bonds for DPS's Bureau of Criminal Apprehension building that were authorized in the year 2000 and sold in the original amount of $8 million. Then there were the St. Paul Port Authority lease revenue bonds for the Anderson and Freeman office buildings that were authorized in 2002 and sold for a total amount of $193 million. The Housing Finance Agency's supportive housing bonds authorized in 2008 and sold in the year or two afterwards were sold for a total of $39 million. The Housing Finance Agency housing infrastructure bonds were authorized in 2012, 2014, and 2015 and have been sold to date in a total amount of $152 million. The University of Minnesota's TCF Bank Stadium bonds were sold in 2006 for an original amount of $137 million. The University of Minnesota's Biosciences Facilities bonds were authorized in 2010, 2011, and 2013 and sold for a total amount of $199 million. The State General Fund Appropriation Refunding bonds, which refinanced the tobacco securitization bonds, were authorized and sold in 2012 for a total amount of $622 million. The professional football stadium appropriation bonds were sold in 2014 for a total amount of $462 million. The certificates of participation for the legislative office facility were sold in 2014 for a total amount of $80 million. And finally, the Lewis and Clark Rural Water System Project appropriation bonds were sold in 2016 for a total amount of $11.8 million. So then to answer Representative Torkelson's question, it was those two certificates of participation on the list that represent the history of state financing in that regard.
Representative Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Are certificates of participation available to other entities within the state government that issue bonds?
Ms. Asimer.
Mr. Chair, Representative, it depends on whether there's appropriate authorizing legislation giving them authority to issue certificates of participation.
Thank you. Another general question about appropriation bonds in general. What is the average maturity of appropriation bonds?
Ms. Asimer.
Mr. Chair, Representative, it does depend on both market conditions and the life of the project, but they can range anywhere from 20 to 30 to 35 years in an extreme situation.
And the average, thank you, Mr. Chair, and the average for regular GO bonds?
Ms. Asimer.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the Constitution limits general obligation bonds to 20 years, and MMV does sell general obligation bonds for 20-year terms.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But the average right now, do you have any idea what the average is for our currently issued GO bonds?
Ms. Hassimer.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I do not. And if you need information about what it would be sort of a weighted remaining life of what our bond portfolio is, we could certainly calculate that for you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But we don't typically issue GO bonds for 20 years, though, do we?
Ms. Hassimer.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we do issue bonds, general obligation bonds for 20-year terms.
All of them? I'm sorry, Mr.
Ms. Asimer.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes.
They are. Okay. I should know that. Thank you.
You know, if I can jump in, here's a question I probably should know the answer to. But what is the difference between a certificate of participation and an appropriation bond? I always thought that the legislative office facility, the new Senate building, was an appropriation bond, not a certificate of participation.
Mr. Chair, they are similar. It generally comes down to the legal documents that are needed to put the deal in place, the deal structure. The legislative office facility, we did sell certificates of participation to finance that. So there is a lease agreement that I believe is between the Department of Administration and the Senate that through that lease agreement, the debt service on those certificates of participation get paid.
Oh, it's because it's in a lease agreement, whereas with, like, the football stadium, there's not a lease agreement there. Is that the main gist of it?
Mr. Chair, that is correct.
All right. Okay. Representative Erdahl and Vogel. Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I'm a testifier. I didn't know the answer to this, but what is the average debt service that we pay on a bonding bill?
Ms. Assamer.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I do not have the numbers with me about the average debt service that is paid on any given bonding bill. I can refer you to, I believe it's page 3 in the debt capacity forecast that has a table showing what our annual, our actual and forecasted debt service costs are for all the various debt captured by the state's guidelines.
Okay,
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Ms. Hassner. Now, that includes a expected $800 million?
Ms. Hassner?
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's correct. The forecasted amount, so on this table from fiscal years 17 through 23, are based on an assumption of $800 million passing being authorized this year, and then $800 million in even years and $230 million in odd years.
So, Ms. Hassler, $1.5 billion bonding bill would increase the capacity or the amount.
Ms. Hassler.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, a bonding bill of $1.5 billion would have an impact because that is above what has been built in through the forecast here.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, Representative Vogel and Liebling. Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Hassmer, curious now, when we talked about the interest rate increase, would that affect the guidelines at all? Let's say for some reason interest rates went up by 2%, which would affect our payments, but it wouldn't necessarily affect the amount outstanding. How is that being controlled so that we wouldn't get in trouble that way?
Ms. Assamer.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the guidelines that we have measure the principal amount of the state's debt. Both guideline number one is the principal amount sold, and guideline number two is the principal amount authorized. That does not factor in the impact of interest rates on debt service costs.
Okay. Representative Vogel.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And as far as the rate difference that was brought up between the general obligations and the appropriation bonds, do you have any idea what the cost difference is between the interest cost, the rate difference would be between the GOs and the other, which would include the appropriation bonds?
Ms. Assamer.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I believe what we forecast is a 1% difference between appropriation bonds and general obligation bonds.
Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's quite a bit on the outstanding. On page 3, looking at the amounts that are there, I noted that the appropriation bonds now have increased from 2008, when I think there was a guideline before that as far as the amount of revenue that could be used for payments that was taken off. The GOs have increased, from what I can determine here, just under $120 million a year, whereas the appropriation bonds have gone up almost $133 million a year. Would that be consistent with what I'm reading here?
Ms. Assamer.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that does appear to be reflected in the table here.
Okay. And
Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess the other thing then, as I look at page 6, I'm seeing that we're forecasting 800, 800 for 17 and 18, and then down to 230 in the odd numbered year and back up. Am I reading that right to see that if we do that without any additional appropriation bonds, just on the GO, that the payments, the annual payments, will go up by another $415 million a year, or is that biennium?
Ms. Assamer.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the table on page 6 represents increased debt service costs on a fiscal year basis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Ms. Assamer, just to follow up on a couple of questions of Representative Wolves, what was the interest rate we paid on our most recent GO bond offering?
Mr. Chair, if memory serves, I believe in our August of 2016 GO bond sale, for the various purpose bonds, we had an interest rate of 2.29%, and for the trunk highway bonds, it was a little less, if I recall correctly, about 2.19%.
Okay, when you say various purpose bonds, you mean a mixture of GO bonds and other bonds? Well, that wouldn't be the case. They were straight GO bonds?
Mr. Chair, they were straight GO bonds. We call them various purpose because they finance all of the different projects authorized in a bonding bill.
Okay, and if I can briefly go back to a question Representative Vogel had on page 6. So he talked about, you know, we're forecasting the $800 million, $800 million, $230 million, et cetera. But again, getting back to that maximum new debt authorizations within debt guidelines, I mean, if I add all those up over the next 6 years, we're assuming we're going to authorize $3.66 billion of bonds, but you're saying we could actually authorize over $10.5 billion of bonds and still say it stay below 3.25% or at 3.25%, which is where we are as of fiscal 2022. How long are you assuming it takes before all the bonds and an authorization are issued? I mean, if we issued $3.45 billion of bonds this year, how long before the last ones would be issued?
Mr. Chair, in a large bonding year, as if $3.45 billion were authorized this year, we would estimate that those would be sold over 5 years. I believe about 15% in the first year, 30% in the next 2 years, and then the smaller amounts in the tails. So it would be... the first sale would not happen until fiscal 18. We typically do a bond sale in the summer, so we do not expect to sell any more bonds in fiscal 17. So then it would be 18 through 22 that the $3.45 billion would be sold.
Well, it just seems strange to me that when I look at this, I gather that the impact on guideline 1 says what it would be if we do the forecast, right? The 3.25%?
Mr. Chair, actually, the impact on guideline number 1 and impact on guideline number 2 are tailored from the maximum debt authorizations reflected on the second line of the table.
Have you done a calculation of where we'd be in fiscal year 23?
Mr. Chair, I don't know if we have those figures.
Well, it just seems surprising that if we're at 2.76% right now, according to what you got on page 5, based on what's outstanding, that if we issued $3.45 billion, which is almost 50% of what's outstanding, that it would, well, hardly change over the next couple years.
And, Mr. Chair, I don't know if there's a question in there.
I guess, are you confident that those figures are accurate?
Mr. Chair, yes, we are. Based on current forecasted interest rates and personal income figures.
Okay. Would you be able to provide those calculations to the committee?
Mr. Chair, which calculations exactly, just so I'm tracking properly?
How you determine the impact on guideline 1 of the maximum new debt authorizations line?
Mr. Chair, we will be able to provide something to the committee for you.
Okay, thank you. Representative Vogel, are you done?
No, not quite, Mr. Chair.
All right, go ahead. Then I've got Representative Liebling and Houseman.
Just one more, Mr. Chair, and Ms. Hassimer. If I'm looking right, out in 2022, we would be then making payments annually of just under $1.1 billion. Would that be right? Because right now I'm totaling it and coming up, I'm taking out the trunk highway because that's kind of revenue-based from another fund, but if we look at the various purpose plus the other tax supported, right now it totals $680. So if we add another $415, I'm coming up with just under $1.1 billion. Am I reading that right?
Ms. Hassemer?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'll trust your math. It looks like you're reading that right.
Well, then, Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment then. What I find troubling is as we get out there, we're going to be making payments of $1.1 billion per year, and yet we're going to be issuing bonds for capital projects of $1.03 billion. If you take the fiscal 21-22 total, the 230 and the 800, it's the most recent issue periods. And I guess when I look at the projections, and that's one of the reasons I was curious about interest rates going up, we're fastly approaching where we're actually paying far more than what we're borrowing, and this would be on a per year basis. So I think just a note of caution when it comes to the borrowings and the projections here that, maybe we have to look at a few different factors because it's really starting to build up and becoming maybe somewhat unsustainable. But that was a comment, not a question. Thank you.
All right. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just going to ask for a couple of additional pieces of information. One is I thought the discussion about the difference between certificates of participation and appropriation bonds was interesting, and I'd like to understand that a little bit better. If you have something that you could share with the committee that would, lay that out a little bit more clearly. And then the second thing is that I was really interested in trying to track as you read through the dates and the outstanding amounts on the original amounts on the bonds that you read through that whole list. And I'm wondering if you could share that list with us. That would be really interesting. It's really interesting to me to see how far down we've paid certain things or not over time. So if you could provide those, I would appreciate it.
Representative Houseman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm concerned that on page 6, we might be continuing to misunderstand this a bit. So what you're saying is the first line is what you assumed in the forecast. The second one is what could be done to a maximum amount, which we're probably not going to do. But then the next three lines are all about that reality. If we did the maximum, that those would be the levels at which we would reach, right?
Ms. Hassemer.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that is correct. And so that last line, that additional debt service required, that would only be if we were actually doing $3 billion, $1 billion on that second line.
Ms. Hassemer.
And I was thinking that was not what Representative Vogel was reading that.
Ms. Hassemer, is that those new debt authorizations, is that all GO debt, or is that a mixture of GO debt and appropriation bonds and other things?
Mr. Chair, that would really be up to the legislature. It could be all GO debt, although it could also be spread amongst trunk highway bonds, appropriation bonds, other lease purchase agreements.
Okay, but if it was spread amongst appropriation bonds and other things, then it wouldn't impact Guideline 1, right? It only impact Guideline 2?
Mr. Chair, it would actually impact both Guideline Number 1 and Number 2. Appropriation bonds are counted against Guideline Number 1.
Okay. Representative Houseman.
So, Mr. Chair.
I'm still a little confused, too, so go ahead.
Okay. Well, I am a little worried about that chart because people are maybe making assumptions about that last line that are perhaps misleading. And this has always been the frustration to me about that forecasted amount. And I think it confuses us more than helps us. And I've sort of argued with the department that by using the historic numbers, they keep us kind of stuck in time. And it means we never write a bigger bonding bill because you've already given us a forecasted amount, which is far under what we could do based on the guideline.
And so that's been the confusing thing for me, why you've chosen to do that, that your forecast is not really a forecast, it's really history. And that's really an observation about something, so I think this is, that whole chart has the potential to confuse us rather than help us, and maybe we need to talk a little more about that. I wanted to just say one thing about the University of Minnesota's use of appropriation bonds, because in their history, they've decided they don't want to do this anymore. They did the stadium, and then they came to us when they wanted to do the research buildings, and they wanted to do like five buildings. And so they came to us saying, give us advance permission. We want you this year to give us the next 5 years of geo-bonding authority. And we said, well, we never do that. That would be unprecedented. We don't do that for Minsky. We don't do it for everyone. They said, well, for research, you have to do it because if you want to recruit faculty, they've got to know that there's going to be a facility there. The final solution was that they said they would do it the way they did the stadium, and that is through the appropriation bond, which then allowed them to have their own schedule for doing the research buildings. But now that they've done it, and they see that it is a different vehicle than geobonding, they have, in some of their regents discussions, I saw that their analysis was they likely wouldn't be willing to do that again. So it is a tool that has some different implications than geobonding.
Well, thank you. Representative Drazkowski, then Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Hassamer, the guideline number one suggests that you compare the total debt sold and currently owed to personal income, and then we compare it to projected personal income in the future. Do we know what personal income is in, you know, actual in, say, 2016, and why hasn't that number been used instead of a future personal income in that calculation?
Ms. Hassamer.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't have the exact rationale, but I believe it's because the bonds would be sold in the future that using the forecasted personal income does a better job of matching up when the bonds will be sold and therefore counted in the guidelines than taking a historical look as to where personal income has been in the past.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Ms. Hassamer. So could you put together kind of those same numbers with the current or actual personal income that's actually proven rather than one that's projected? Could you kind of do that same chart on the top of five for that for us? And then one more question if I have, Mr. Chair.
Yep, Representative Drazkowski.
Ms. Hassamer, I noticed the table on the top of page 3 looks at the annual debt service costs and observed, and I think my numbers are right, a 134% increase from of debt service payments or costs that the state is paying on our huge and rapidly growing pile of debt that we have. So 2006 we were at about $400 million and 2016 at $938 million. Can you graph that out for us and send it out, email it out to the committee, including the source file, so that we can use that accordingly?
Ms. Hassamer.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we'll be happy to get you some information to those two points.
Thank you.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Hassamer, Representative Drazkowski was just pointing out the actual annual debt service costs over time, and found it really kind of jaw-dropping at how fast our debt service costs are increasing over time since the time that I've been here. And when I was a freshman, I was on the Capital Investment Committee, and I was trying to figure out how the bonds work, and somebody told me to go ask Representative Knobloch, and he must have sized up how dense I was, and he told me to reserve at least an hour. And I think he gave me probably an hour and a half trying to explain how all this stuff works at that time. It was very helpful. This year, you are, I think, accusing my committee of being the fastest increaser of the budget, of which we are we do increase our costs a lot, and I'm trying to watch that. But it looks to me like our debt service costs are increasing faster than even HHS budget costs are increasing. And Representative Vogel correctly points out that if we didn't have any debt, we could pay cash every year and get more stuff. So I think that's kind of a troubling statistic. So I'm glad that we, if you look back at 6 and 7, we had we had 870 combined over the biennium, and now we're at 1.9. But what we're buying has not obviously gone up that much. So am I right? Is this the fastest growing area of the state budget?
Ms. Hassamer?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I am not an expert on the entire state budget, so I cannot answer the relative growth of debt service to other areas in the budget.
Well, I think I'm probably pretty close. So, Representative, if the chairman would quit picking on me so much as being the worst offender, I think I found a worse offender than my committee.
Well, Representative Dean, let me just assure you it's nothing personal. I think, Representative Dean, yours is the fastest growing in absolute terms, in terms of, like, the total amount. But this might be the fastest growing in percentage terms, at least if you looked at, say, you know, we don't really have all the 16-17 in yet, and of course there wasn't a bonding bill last year, so I don't know if you compared 12 and 13 to 14-15. All right, Representative, did you have something else, Representative Dean?
No, just I remember a couple of years ago when we were trying to get the money to fix up the Capitol, Representative Carlson, I think, called me from North Dakota, and he asked if we wanted to borrow some money to fix up our pretty capital, because I made fun of their capital, because he pointed out the fact that they don't have bonds, they just pay cash.
Look what they did.
Yeah.
All right. Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do just need to cite what the USA Today study from the 24/7 Wall Street ranking of the best run states in America. We are not in the top 5. We are not in the top 10. We are not in the top 15 of debt per capita. We are 19th lowest in the nation. And every time rating agencies look at us for the rating they're going to give us, they always say, first of all, they compliment us about these guidelines, that we have guidelines and we stay within them, and that's a good thing. And it's based on something. Those, by the way, those two guidelines are Governor Pawlenty's guidelines. That's how long we have been living within them. The frustration, I think, if we just look at history, Governor Arne Carlson was the first governor to sign a billion-dollar bonding bill. And if you just did inflation, if we were going to do the same thing today for infrastructure, what he was doing then, our bonding bills would be closer to 1.4, between 1.4 and 1.5. That every year we fall behind. The bonding bill is like your home mortgage in your family. And I suspect there are probably not many families that can pay cash for their house. That's a kind of debt that families see as a responsible long-term. That's an asset they're going to be using long-term, and it makes sense. So our debt is not huge and rapidly growing. We rank right in the middle of all of the states. That's acknowledged by the rating agencies every time they take a look at us.
Hey, Representative Hausman, my recollection also is that we've normally been seen as being somewhat in the middle of the pack in terms of total state debt per capita. Now, we didn't have a big bonding bill this last year, so I don't know if we had had one, how that would have affected things. Obviously, would have moved up in ranking somewhat, but Representative Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hausman, I appreciate your analogy to the family budget, but I would point out that families don't buy another new house every 2 years.
Any other questions from members? Well, seeing none,
Assistant Commissioner Hassemer, thank you again for coming in on President's Day when everyone else that works with you is probably sitting at home. So we really appreciate you being here today, and would appreciate you working and getting us some of that other information, too, when you can. Thank you very much. And members, with that, the meeting is adjourned.